from deep inside your audio device of choice. Ladies and gentlemen, this week's program is about everything else, starting with this.
AI's great, just first rate, love or hate, it's the gold state. AI is fine, like a well-edged wine, more like rhyme than turpentine.
This from the Census Bureau, which puts out a business trends and outlook survey of more than a million firms every couple of weeks. The most recent one asked whether a business has used an AI tool to help produce goods or services in the past 2 weeks. After reviewing the data, the chief economist of Apollo noted that AI adoption among large companies, more than 250 employees, has actually started declining. Why would that be? It's great. A publisher has found that less than 25% of authors disclosed their use of AI to prepare manuscripts, despite the publisher mandating disclosure for submission. American Association for Cancer Research found that 23% of abstracts and manuscripts and 5% of peer review reports submitted to its journals last year contained text that was probably generated by LLMs, large language models. Publishers also found that less than 25% of authors disclosed their use of AI to prepare manuscript. Quote, "We were shocked when we saw the results of the survey. The analysis found that AI-generated text in peer review reports dropped by 50% in late 2023 after the American Association of Cancer Research mandated disclosure, but detections of AI-generated text in peer-review comments more than doubled by early last year and have continued to climb. When you're trying to cheat, AI is great. And now, news of microplastics. The surge in the use of disposable face masks during the COVID pandemic, you remember that, right, has left a chemical time bomb that could harm humans, animals, and the environment. And the environment, well, just one of them. This is according to research reported in The Guardian this week. Millions of tons of plastic face masks created to protect people from the spread of the virus are now breaking down, releasing microplastics and chemical additives, including endocrine disruptors, according to the research. I don't want my endocrine disrupted. I don't know about you. As a result of very equipment whose use was intended to protect people during the pandemic now poses a risk to the health of people and the planet. You know, maybe for generations is all. Quote, this study has underlined the urgent need to rethink how we produce, use, and dispose of face masks, says a researcher at Coventry University in Britain. It's been estimated during the height of the pandemic, 129 billion disposable face masks, mostly made of polypropylene, thank you, and other plastics were being used every month around the world. No recycling stream occurred. Most ended up either in landfill or littered in streets, parks, benches, waterways, and rural areas where they've now begun to degrade. Recent research has reported a significant presence of disposable face masks in both terrestrial and aquatic environments. Two researchers examined many different kinds of masks, but it was the FFP2 and FFP3 masks, which were marketed as the gold standard protection against the transmission of the virus, that leached the most microplastics, releasing 4 to 6 times as many. The researchers made an even more worrying discovery. Subsequent chemical analysis of what leached found medical masks also released bisphenol B. That's an endocrine-disrupting chemical that acts like estrogen when absorbed into the bodies of humans and animals. I noticed myself growing breasts. No, I didn't. Taking into account the total amount of single-use face masks produced during the height of the pandemic, researchers estimated they led to the release of 282 to 472 pounds of bisphenol B into the environment every single day. Said one of the researchers, we can't ignore the environmental cost of single-use masks, especially when we know that the microplastics and chemicals they release can negatively affect both people and ecosystems. I'm more concerned about ecosystems. Personally, this summer researchers published their findings on the potential dangers of microplastics to the blood-brain barrier in the journal Molecular Neurobiology. They focused on one of the most common types of plastic, low-density polyethylene. Researchers didn't find any indication of swelling or excess fluid in the brains of the group exposed to plastics. They did discover that the blood-brain barrier, which acts as our brain's security system to keep harmful substances out, had become compromised. This would allow toxins and pathogens to enter more freely. And it found that a crucial antioxidant enzyme decreased while levels of a marker of cell damage increased in the mice exposed to the plastics. I blame the mice. News of microplastics. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Well, maybe not that cheap. Costs for safety measures by the 11 power companies in Japan who are trying to restart idle nuclear reactors in the aftermath of Fukushima, those costs have ballooned to $43 billion, according to a survey by the Japanese newspaper Asahi Shimbun. Expenses tend to rise significantly during the final security screening process for bringing the reactors back online, so they may go up again. Total expenditures are expected to continue spiking dramatically, says the paper, given that 8 reactors are currently undergoing this particularly difficult final safety checks process. The cost advantage afforded by nuclear power generation over other forms of power generation was undermined following the Fukushima accident, prompting a novel financing system to be instituted to shift the growing burden of safety countermeasures onto, guess who, the public. Hey, we can take it. And the back in this country, the Energy Department this week fired a top official who did oversee the cleanup of decades worth of pollution left over from nuclear weapons development and nuclear research. This is at the DOE's Office of Environmental Management. Roger Jarrell, terminated from his position as Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of that office, according to the Energy Department. He was a lawyer who also served during Trump's first term, was also tapped earlier this year to serve as the office's acting assistant secretary. When firing Jarrell, Energy Secretary Chris Wright expressed a desire to go in a, quote, different direction, unquote, on the cleanup at Hanford, the former plutonium plant in Washington State. According to a person with knowledge of the event, granted anonymity because they're scared. They said they believe DOE, Department of Energy leadership, wants to get rid of the so-called waste treatment and immobilization plant project, the WTP. That's a project that wants to clean up radioactive waste at the site along the Columbia River. It could cost up to $30 billion and has taken almost 3 decades to build. Quote, I think they want to kill it all together, even though it's close to being operational, said the anonymous source. Said a DOE spokesperson, we can confirm Roger Jarrell is no longer with the department. Hanford, as you know, is the site of a costly and longstanding cleanup effort that made its way into Project 2025. The complex, now home to almost 200 tanks containing 57 million gallons of high-level nuclear waste left over from weapons production. Which means they could have put it into the weapons. I don't know. And now, news of the godly. Well, This story may be coming to an end, or maybe not. The New Orleans Archdiocese has agreed to a $230 million settlement proposed for survivors of clergy sexual abuse. That's according to attorneys for some of the survivors this week. The agreement paves the way for a final resolution to years-long negotiations amid a series of similar settlements from the same church, Catholic. The Archdiocese had, in May, announced it would pay at least $179 million in response to more than 500 abuse claims. The attorneys said they opposed that because they thought it was lowballing the hundreds of survivors. The Archdiocese filed for bankruptcy May 2020, so they wouldn't have to handle each abuse claim separately. The Archdiocese called the updated settlement, quote, a significant step forward for the benefit of all claimant survivors. Survivors have until October to vote on whether or not to approve the settlement. God bless them. And over in England, a former school chaplain who sexually assaulted pupils in his care has been stripped, pardon the expression, of his MBE, member of the British Empire. That's an honor reserved for chaplains who abuse. No. Timothy Biles, he was 90. He carried out attacks at a school for boys in Dorset a long time ago. But in 2020, he was honored for services to the church. However, he was jailed for 6 years last year for 5 counts of indecent assault. And now he loses his MBE. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. I mentioned New Orleans this week. The felon-in-chief announced he's not sending troops here to New Orleans, but rather to Memphis, Tennessee. I guess the second lines scared him. There will be more about New Orleans moments from now here on Le Show. this is the show. And a few days ago, this country, in a weird way, commemorated the 20th anniversary of the flooding of New Orleans. I'm peculiar enough to insist that much of the real story has not yet been communicated to the rest of the country. But even so, a new wrinkle to the disaster that befell New Orleans 20 years ago has been made public in a weekly newspaper in New Orleans called The Lens. Full disclosure, I'm a member of the board of The Lens. And the reporter who came up with that story is on the line with us today. Delaney Nolan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Hi, Harry.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you. So last we knew, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had constructed a new $14 billion, not a hurricane protection system, a hurricane risk reduction system, their words, that they said, as of 2012, was ready for action. They had to replace the original pumps. Other things happened. But we're supposedly now in a state where we think we in New Orleans are safe and protected. And you came up with some new information. What did you discover?
Sure. So there were sort of two areas that I was looking at. And this started with a conversation with you. We were talking about some concerns and issues that had come up several years ago related to the pumps, where the pumps weren't keeping up with the water that was going into the canals. So I'm going to zoom out for a minute just in case anyone listening isn't familiar with our complicated levee pump flood wall system. We have three outfall canals in New Orleans. And when it rains heavy from a storm or just from a heavy rain, the Sewage and Water Board pumps standing water in the city into these canals. And then from the canals, it goes into Lake Pontchartrain. When there's storm surge, so a hurricane is coming in, it's pushing all this water in front of it, the Army Corps will close the gates between the canal and the lake so that water doesn't come from the lake into the canals and continue to pump water from the canals into the lake. Ideally, that's what will happen. It first came up that there were some problems with the pumps pretty much right away after Katrina, after they were building the system. And so the gates that we have between the canals and the lake, we didn't have those during Katrina. This didn't exist yet. That's a new installation. But they started to put in these new pumps, and pretty much right away, there were problems with these pumps that were meant to be temporary anyway. But, you know, right away, we started seeing signs of corrosion. They broke over and over and over again because of rust and corrosion. They kept having to take them out and repair them and put them back in. They were only supposed to be there for 3, 4, 5 years. We ended up having them for, I think, over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when we put in the permanent pumps, which are what we have now, we found, again, pretty soon after they got put in, that they have this corrosion. So that came a couple years ago, and they did the repairs and at last completed them very recently this year. The problem is the repairs that they made to these pumps are the same repairs that they did with the temporary pumps, which, as we know, were not lasting fixes. They continued to rust and corrode over and over again. But that's a long way of saying this is problem one. We have these pumps that have corroded before. We've been told that they're fixed, but the fixes that have been done are the same fixes that didn't really stick the first time.
Let me ask you a question. Why are they rusting and corroding?
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things that came up for me is part of the problem is that brackish water, which is not quite salt water, not fresh water, it's kind of somewhere in the middle, is actually more corrosive than either fresh water or salt water. So these pumps, right, these are these like massive installations. They're huge. They power over you if you see them.
Mm-hmm.
and they go down below your feet into the water. So there's parts of them that are just standing in water all the time. Mm-hmm. And brackish water will corrode metal, of course. And these pumps were made with carbon steel. So carbon steel is a lot more prone to corrosion than stainless steel. And when these new permanent pumps were put in a few years ago, the contractor said, yeah, we're using carbon steel, but don't worry, they're not going to corrode. These are going to last for 35 years without any problems. And then that turned out not to be true. When brackish water hits carbon steel, it does lead to corrosion. It leads to rust. So these repairs looked like both the previous ones and the ones they're doing now looks like taking out these carbon steel parts, replacing them with stainless steel parts, adding a kind of anti-corrosion coating, and just generally like repairing bits of them. But the actual permanent fix that would be needed would be to replace the entire thing with stainless steel. And then also something called cathodic protection, which means having essentially like a little electrical current that means that it will corrode. They did suggest they put in corrosion protection when they were first installed. That didn't happen. And now they're looking at doing it now, but the work for that has not begun yet. And we are told that will be completed by the end of the year. But obviously, as you can hear, these pumps have not always stuck with the timelines we've been told to expect.
Mm-hmm. Is the tendency of brackish water to corrode faster or more intensely than either salt or fresh water, is that known to people like the Army Corps of Engineers?
I would certainly think that an engineer would know that, yeah. And one of the things I was told is that when they first put in these pumps, contractors said that they were not told that these would be exposed to water, which is...
Pumps not exposed to water, eh?
I know, which is kind of mystifying.
Yeah. What would they be pumping then? The other question that occurs is, would the fact that carbon steel is more likely to corrode than stainless steel be a fact generally known perhaps to engineers?
Yeah, that certainly would. I mean, the fact that they know that the fix involves replacing one type of steel with another type of steel, I think tells us that we know that this is a fix that was not used when it should have been used, I would say.
So instead of doing those fixes or doing those changes at the time the system was installed and it was on at least partly on dry land, they're now supposedly doing these fixes with these parts that are underwater?
They say that they have already replaced the ones that are constantly touching water. And the fix that we're waiting for now is this cathodic protection, where they sort of add an electrical current that would go through the part and allow like a zinc coating, essentially, to be the part that corrodes. But it is something that could have been avoided, I would say, if they had been installed with all stainless steel parts and with cathodic protection in the first place. So, and one of the reasons that this is concerning is that if these pumps don't work, what we would end up potentially seeing is the water not being able to get pumped out of these canals into the lake. And then if the water limits exceeded their maximum, which is depending on what part of what canal you're looking at, is going to be 8 feet or possibly 10 feet. These canals are not designed to hold water past that limit, and then we would be starting to worry about a breach.
If those walls were challenged in the way you described, the possible fate of New Orleans neighborhoods would be something similar to what happened 20 years ago, right?
Oh, yeah. If we're talking about the canal walls, there have been concerns since their repair and reconstruction that they are still not quite up to par. There's a point, I want to say it was Hurricane Isaac, where the pumps, because we still had these temporary rusty ones in, were not quite working the way they were designed to. And so they had to keep telling Sewage and Water Board, stop pumping water into the canals. Didn't give a reason, but the reason was clearly that they could not then pump the water out of the canals fast enough to prevent them from exceeding that limit or overtopping. And I think around that time, it also became clear that the limit had not been raised the way they said they were going to raise it immediately after Katrina. I think they said that they were going to raise it 1 or 2 feet, and it looked like they only ended up raising the limit half a foot. I don't want to say I'm positive that those numbers are true, though, because I'd have to go back and look, but the limit was not increased as much as they had originally said that they were going to. And yeah, there have been some other concerns about the canal since then, like that the filling that they were built on is not reliable, and that essentially there's trash inside them.
Mm-hmm. And just for people who don't know the geography of New Orleans, if that water, which is probably rainwater, that's what New Orleans gets a lot of, is mm-hmm. not being allowed to be pumped into the canals by the Corps telling the Sewage and Water Board, don't pump your water in. Where does that water go?
Right. And that goes into our streets, into our houses.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's sort of an urban myth that the entire city is below sea level. We're about half below sea level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the reason that we need those city pumps, those Sewage and Water Board pumps, is because we need help to drain the water out. So if the canals did breach, during Katrina, those were some of the breaches. The very famous one mm-hmm. is the Industrial Canal being breached and flooding the lower Ninth Ward. But there were actually dozens of breaches mm-hmm. of levees, canals, and flood walls, including these outfall canals.
Mm-hmm. Do you have information regarding what this current set of fixes that we've been describing costs?
I don't have those numbers handy here. I've been told that the great majority of them will be covered by the contractors who put them in the first place, and the ones who said that these pumps would last for 35 years. So we shall see. And then there was an additional concern that came up in this reporting. So the pumps are sort of the big, or one of the main ones. And a lot of us know about that already here, because the corrosion on the pumps has been sort of this ongoing legacy for years and years. It's something that seems to come up again as a problem almost every year. But there was another problem that was really seemed to be in the forefront of people's minds a decade ago, and it just kind of quietly dropped off. This whole system, lots of metal, lots of water, lots of places where we can worry about rust and corrosion, including underneath the levees themselves. So under the levees are these big, again, steel
mm-hmm.
piles. They're H-shaped piles that are there to basically prop the levee up, make sure it doesn't shift or slump over. But when the Army Corps is putting these in, it was trying to keep to a certain budget and a certain schedule, and they didn't have the right equipment on site to do what is their normal standard practice, which would be to coat the steel that's going underground in a kind of coal epoxy coating that would prevent corrosion. So normally when Army Corps builds something that involves underground steel, they cover it with this anti-corrosion material.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided, we don't really have the material or the budget or the time to do that. So they requested a waiver, which they received, that allowed them to instead just add a little bit more steel that would then be deliberately allowed to rust. They call it sacrificial steel, and it just means they built the whole thing a little bit thicker, mm-hmm. and they say, yeah, this is going to rust, this is going to corrode, but we made it extra big, so it's fine. We're just going to let it rust and corrode. Lots of people didn't like that plan at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It got pushback from essentially every other agency involved. So that would be CPRA, the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, the Levee Board, the Flood Protection Authority, who were raising alarms and saying no, and also just onlookers, other experts in corrosion, were all saying, no, come on, you'll have to do it the normal way that you normally do it. You have to include this anti-corrosion measure. And eventually they got through, Army Corps agreed. But by the time they had agreed, most of the piles had already gotten the ground because they had continued to work while this debate was going on. So only something like, you know, estimates vary, but something like 20% of these piles ended up getting the anti-corrosion measure. And the Army Corps said, okay, because there is concerns about this, we've had a, they did a study, CPRA did a study. They said, in order to find out whether this is going to actually be enough, we're going to put in a monitoring program. We're going to monitor it, see if it's behaving the way we expected, or if we need to change our designs. Mm-hmm. And that was 10 years ago, and that is the last we have heard of it. So we have not gotten any data or updates released. The name of the contractor was not in any public documents I could find without filing a FOIA or public records requests. And even the, I mean, honestly, the people that I spoke to at CPRA and at Army Corps seemed to have fairly limited information that they had or were able to share with me about it. So that program, that monitoring program, is just finishing around now. They said that they will have the data ready and analyzed and prepared to share next year. But in the meantime, we just don't know how they're doing, to be honest.
A big picture question. How long has the Army Corps of Engineers been putting metal parts in water?
Oh, a long time, Harry.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Maybe. I would say it's got to be over a century.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of their major activity, isn't it, in a lot of places?
It is kind of their big thing, yeah. God, I guess it's it might be closer to 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that it is their standard practice and they had to ask for a waiver for it, that itself tells us, you know, there's a reason that it is standard practice for them to use this anti-corrosion material.
By the way, just to finish that point, who granted them the waiver?
The Army Corps granted the New Orleans District of the Army Corps.
Oh, so the Army Corps granted the Army Corps a waiver.
You could say that, yeah.
I did say that. All right, then. So what else have we not talked about that's germane to this?
So 10 years have passed. We've learned a few things since then. And the two things that I think are kind of important for this underground steel that may or may not be rusting is, one, subsidence. So New Orleans is squishy. Everyone here knows that our ground is kind of settling, it's subsiding, it's squishing down. You know, we just live in like a big vat of pudding. And as we continue to drain water out of it, especially, it settles further and further and further. So just, I think it was earlier this year, we got some more data. A study came out looking at just how fast that subsidence is happening. And they found that it was happening the fastest right around these pilings that we're talking about, the flood walls that are in St. Bernard. But that's worrying because when this stuff subsides, it creates little air pockets. This was part of the original concern, is subsidence creating air pockets. And when that exposes steel to oxygen, that also leads to corrosion. So something we're already worried about. And it looks like we just, 1.9 inches a year. We just found out that it's happening very fast and in the area that we're worried about. And we've also just learned a little bit more since then about how steel corrodes under the ground. So when the Army Corps made this decision, they looked at all these different corrosion rates of buried steel in different areas and different environments. And they said, based on all this data, here's how fast we think it's going to corrode. And we think an extra eighth of an inch of steel is going to be enough. And since then, we've had some more information. Essentially, it just says we don't know enough to make these estimates. It seems to vary a lot depending on where it's buried and what the environment is like. And we just, there's still too much that we don't know for us to really be reliably making these predictions.
Wow. Delaney, you've done amazing work. The Lens did amazing work in getting that story out at the 20th anniversary, and the national media have done amazing work in ignoring it. So I'm really grateful to you for doing the reporting and for sharing it with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate you keeping an eye on this and getting the word out. There are a lot of things to be worried about in the national level right now. So I understand when people are distracted, but I do think it's something that we all want to keep an eye on. And I hope we can check back in when this data comes out next year, whenever they release it.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Don't go near the water. Don't you think it's sad? What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man.
Along with our post-20th anniversary coverage of the flooding of New Orleans, a look at a possible different future. On the line with me today is an old friend and advisor, David Wagoner of the New Orleans architecture and environment firm of Wagoner and Ball. David in San Francisco today, welcome to the show.
Nice to hear from you, Harry.
Yeah. So when we last met, which was in the wake of the flood, you were embarked on a project called Dutch Dialogues. Refresh the memory for that.
Well, what are we going to do about it? You know, who has better knowledge than we do about how to reconstitute a city? And the Dutch are pretty good about water, and they have a great idea about how to invest in things over time to get benefits for the society. It was a design forward approach, Harry. It wasn't just planning. It was really looking at what the physical ramifications, social impacts, I remember you saying, I think it was Dutch Alex who found a report afterward, not to me. You said something in media about it being the first thing you'd seen that acknowledged there was a city before, which I appreciate because, you know, we it's conservation and preservation. It's not greenfield. Mm-hmm. I think the cities are existing. There's always prior investment, civilizations, but generations have, you know, built things and invested their lives. The real thing, the ineffable. But anyway, the Dutch, we were able to organize through the Dutch government a really powerful network that carried on, and we did a water plant for New Orleans afterward. We did Dutch dialogues elsewhere, but I think the topic here is Dutch dialogues in New Orleans.
Yeah. So now 2 decades have passed. I'm aware that you had some sort of agreement for a project in the Gentilly area of New Orleans. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Gentilly was identified from early on as a indicator, a district. It's low, it's middle class, low, middle, some upper middle, but a nice mix below sea level, bound by the ridge, the lake. So it was an area to look at, and we've continued to work out there and look there. We did a resilience plan, a district level resilience plan in the last few years for Gentilly, looking at more than water. New Orleans has an economic issue as well as a flood issue. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to look at what would it take to regenerate some activity. The project that's most notable in there are many. We did actually for the city in the National Disaster Resilience Competition, we formulated a program and asked for $280 million, got 140 or 141 from the federal government through HUD for projects throughout Gentilly. We had separate funding for Mirabeau, we call Water Garden, which is in the Gentilly district, 25-acre site. That was FEMA funding, and that is under construction. The other projects still haven't started construction.
So what would be the difference in the way Gentilly neighborhood district deals with water now and under these plans?
This is the storage, the shift from the paradigm that was clear that we pipe everything and pump everything. So all the water that falls, you have to get rid of. This is more saying, well, how about we use it to irrigate? How about we use it to enliven the landscapes so we actually let water stay in place? In this case, in the Mirabeau project, we actually pump water up into the site on one side, and the other side, gravity can bring it in so that you're taking it out of the system. You know, it's like a highway. You want to keep the cars off at rush hour, so you slow down the flow down the road, down the lanes. Mm-hmm. It's basically an off-ramp for water. But not just an off-ramp for water, a place for people and birds and other species. But it's an infrastructure project first, and then it becomes layering in the more natural aspects there. The other aspects of this, though, were to make water visible, because New Orleans, in Dutch terms, is a polder. You know that word, mm-hmm. that I know you know, but maybe the listeners don't know, which is a generally below sea level area, but bound by levees so that the water has to be managed within and lifted out. New Orleans is bizarre because it's a hidden polder. It is everything I said. It's below sea level. It's got to be managed within. It's got to be lifted out. But we don't have the surface water. We still, New Orleanians have resisted opening the landscape to put water in visible places. The outfall canals that are part of the remnant hurricane defense system, you still have concrete walls that don't function. Mm-hmm. Courts and columns, secondary lines of defense, they have holes in them. They're not going to work for that. So it's this hidden polder, the inability to face the actually attractive reality or possibility. You know, most places real estate pictures are made alongside water, aren't they? And we have all the water, but we don't want to take advantage of it.
We don't want to see it.
It's not just the trauma, it's the conditioning. I think, Harry, the trauma's real. I think it's at 20, I felt it in the city again. You know, it didn't go away. Mm-hmm. And water, you know, is a healing element. You know, I could go off on the spiritual side of all that. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it's good for you and it makes the air cooler. And, you know, New Orleans is not the coolest place in the summertime. So, you know, more water, more trees. I mean, it's not a recipe that rationally you would oppose. Mm. But, you know, much of what people do is not rational.
Tell me about it. I think you described the Dutch approach, or the difference between the Dutch approach and our current approach, fairly pithily, as the difference between living with water and a war on water.
Peace would be a better way to live in a civil society. You know, the system in New Orleans came into being in the 1920s with pumping and trying to engineer your way with all these pipes and conduits to get the water to the lake. But there's no benefit from that. There's just cost and exercise and energy use. The more passive approach to live with water, but that doesn't mean you just lie down and let it go wherever it does. It means more that you make space for it. You figure out where you want it to be and hope you can design the boundary conditions so that it does go there and does stay there under the different conditions of stress and design has to accommodate those thresholds. Mm-hmm. New Orleans has incorporated a lot of storage to slow the impact on these pumps, but much of it is underground. It's hard for me to make a case for a open green field that I can't put a tree on versus a more organic environment or natural environment where I can have trees and water blended together. There are instances, as you well know, in the city park and others that take great advantage of this would-be natural environment. Mm-hmm. But, the human-made is maybe where the war aspect comes in. We're warring against our own best interest often.
Hmm. We mentioned the project in Gentilly. Have you been doing similar projects or even more ambitious projects in other cities?
Yes, because the problem is not confined to New Orleans.
Yeah.
I'm in San Francisco. We're beginning a good project on the Embarcadero here. San Francisco's issues aren't quite the same. They don't have hurricanes, do they? They don't have the rainfall that we have. But we've had, we are working in Miami. That's a hard condition, the soils, and that's actually limestone and hard to keep the water down. That's a different problem. But the methodologies that we learned in New Orleans carry over. We're working in Charleston, trying to get ahead of the core there on what the line, the perimeter around the peninsula of that part of the city would be. We did a water plan for Charleston that looked at the rest of the city. Charleston's actually five, you could call, boroughs. But the peninsula is one, the most famous and the most at risk of flood. So we've been working there, doing things there. We're in Bridgeport, Connecticut, trying to get some things done there that are similar, you know, water park and perimeter defense. And then how does the water aggregate toward a pump that would have to lift it out into a park? The most effective place we've worked, the most productive, has been Norfolk and Hampton Roads area, Chesapeake. Those cities there have taken it on, and why those places have done better than others that I said we won $140 million for the city of New Orleans in the National Disaster Resilience Competition. We won $120 million for Norfolk, and that project was finished 3 years ago.
Wow.
And broken ground. It's something in culture, and we talk about war and all that. You know, there is something to recommend a military culture in terms of getting things done. And this is way beyond the time we have to talk about today, but the mindset of do your job. Norfolk, they do their job and they built this stuff, and people are beginning to, because you have to build it and then operate it. as we know well with the pumps and levees in New Orleans, you have to operate these systems, and they're not free to operate. And you've got to understand, you know, the maintenance and operations there that comes from them. But this has gone around. You know, we did some work internationally, but it's really an American problem and the American system. The Dutch didn't have the staying power to survive the irrationality of America. Mm. You know, it's like a good idea. Why wouldn't you do it? You prove you will do better if you do this. Of course, you would do it. Well, not necessarily in our fine land.
Speaking of which, what's the relationship of your enterprise with the Army Corps of Engineers?
You know, our work as Wagner and Ball has been mostly for the urban entity, the city, with the Corps. We aren't directly employed by the Corps. We have had a great deal of interface with the Corps in these other places. Mm-hmm. But we are working on behalf of the city in these places, the cities in these places. But we certainly have insight into the Corps of Engineers and the procedures that are involved.
The estimate I read the other day is that the Corps now estimates it's going to be $1 billion to rebuild or fortify the current system against the reduction of level of the land and the raise in the level of the sea over the next couple decades. Is there any insight you've got into how that $1 billion could be better spent?
I wish, Harry, I did. You know, part of the motivation for what we've done, working mostly in New Orleans on the inside of the levees, was to create enough of a tax base to pay for what you got to do to sustain the levees. Mm. I hear different numbers and see different dates. I've seen a date of 2070 for that, which would make a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know what we're doing to sea level either, by the way. That's another parenthesis. You can go over there and talk about how fast we want to speed that up, because mm-hmm. it seems that we're determined to worsen that curve mm-hmm. instead of lessen that curve. Mm-hmm. In New Orleans, we're beginning to do a better job of making people deal with subsidence and our own human-made causes of subsidence, okay? The drainage system and the pumping of groundwater through it. That work, I think people are getting, many more people know about than they did 20 years ago or 10 years ago. But the, you know, in Dutch formulation, if you have a capital expense on flood defense, which is generally what we could call this, mm-hmm. you need to budget about 1% of that capital investment per annum for maintenance. Mm. You don't spend it the first year. Mm-hmm. So if we spent 14, 15 billion, you would be figuring, you know, over a 50-year cycle that you're going to run lots of 1%, right? So 50%, I mean, I can see the number, Harry. You know, we're in this deltaic plain. Nothing's very stable. I think the lessening the burden of pumping, you know, you have to pump once you're within this polder. You have to pump it out. It, you know, New Orleans has been doing this, but it's been relying solely on that. So leaving water in the ground lessens subsidence. Hmm. I mean, La Vie Flottante. I don't say that very well, but, you know, the floating city. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what we were trying to say to people. You have to learn to float here. The negative press that's been written about the city and surely the return to a swamp. Well, you can live in places like this if you'll just learn to let the water be, you know, live alongside you. And that isn't necessarily death. But I think people see urbanization in a either or way. So I don't know if I'm answering precisely your question, but the fact of the matter is you do have to reinvest in these systems once you have them. It's not an inexpensive city to live in. Mm-hmm. You're binding yourself into recurring cost.
Right. Just last minute, your one word view of New Orleans, optimistic or pessimistic?
My former business partner called me a grim optimist. We cannot afford to fiddle around like we are, though. we can't operate in New Orleans without a business community stepping up. We have to have resources other than just tourism that can drive an economy that allows us to reinvest and keep this place alive. It's still magic, Harry.
It is. Yeah.
But you can't rely on the goodwill of others. You've got to do something for yourself. So I think the politics of the last few years have been very hard for New Orleans. Mm-hmm. The performance of the government has been less than stellar. You know, we have to do better. You know, but if you tell me I got to do better, I'd probably shape up and do a little bit better. And I think New Orleans can do that.
David, thanks for your time. Thanks for your expertise. Thanks for your persistence.
Thank you, Harry.
That's it for this week's edition of the show. Back next week, same time, same radio station, or on your audio device of choice whenever you want it. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego desk, to Pam Halstead, to Thomas Walsh at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's program. Hey, the Hawaii desk helped out too. The email address for this program, a chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts, ask your dad. And the playlist of the music heard here on, as well as a lot of stuff to watch and read and listen to and cogitate about, all at harryshearer.com. And I'm on Blue Sky at Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from the Crescent City.